Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. Find us on the web at myrecoverycast.com or in our Facebook group, also called My Recovery Cast, all one word. We're also on iTunes and Stitcher, depending on your device, and you can simply stream these shows directly from our website as well. Today's episode is an interview with Tonya from Greece, a member who got clean there during the early days of the Greek NA Fellowship. We talk a little bit about those early days and the development of the fellowship there. Then we take an extended, deep dive into the principles and experiences available through the recovery process. As I say early on in the interview, if you want to really explore the big existential issues of life and death, of joy and suffering, of surrender and the awakening of spirit, talk to a Greek. And better yet, talk to one who is brilliant and articulate, who has faced serious illness and all the deep introspection that brings on, and who has found a freedom that comes through the various deaths and reawakenings that the recovery journey serves up. So as usual, let's get started with some questioning from Dave.
Okay, thanks, Ron. Well, good morning, Tonya. It's a pleasure to meet you, and I've visited your country in the past. It's absolutely lovely. So, but we always start out by asking our guests, how did you encounter the NA message?
So, good morning to both of you. It's evening for me over here. And how did I encounter? Well, so I was planning to commit suicide. After being a codependent, I had sent my boyfriend away, whom I was using with. And I've sent him away to France, where there were friends over there that were recovering, and I stayed behind. And I thought, okay, I realized that, you know, that thought dawned on me. Somehow I was using and always believing that it's okay, I'm going to pull through it. You know, it's a phase and then it's going to be okay. And I'm telling you, it was such a huge surprise when I realized that there is no way to beat this. It was such a surprise. I didn't have a clue. I was so naive about the whole thing. I thought I can beat it, you know, actually really believe it. And then the realization came that it's not going to happen. So I thought, okay, I had come down low enough. And the next step for me to go out in the streets, you know, to sell myself and stuff like that. It was the natural thing. I had exploited everything around me. There was nothing left, you know, friends, families. And I'd done it all so far, which was kind of decent still. So for me, it was either do that or die, you know. So I realized that there is no way I can do the other thing, you know, like it was really too much for me, you know. I couldn't go through that kind of humiliation, so I decided I'm going to commit suicide since I lost my battle, you know, with drugs. In any case, what happened, because my whole beginning of recovery and the rest of it, I think it was I had angels around me all along. I believe that I've had angels around me all along, you know, trying to keep me from the worst disasters. And by that time, my boyfriend, who was really, I wasn't such a, how can I say, I wasn't using like for 20 years, you know what I mean? I was using for 7 years. My boyfriend was using for 25 years, you know. So he comes back and he's clean. He got the message from NA in France. Mm. So he came back with a message, you know, and I got very angry and I thought, okay, what's this, you know? I mean, he's the junkie, you know? I mean, he's telling me to recover and if I don't do my stuff, I should go away and stuff like that. I thought, no, no. There was such a reverse of roles suddenly, you know? I got very angry. And I thought, I'm going to go down there in Greece, now in Athens, where they meet, and I'm going to confront them, you know, because they really what are they doing? You know, you know how irrational you can be. And I mean, I was supposed to be the one who wanted to get clean, you know, and now he is clean. And that really hurt my ego, you know. I mean, I was the good girl. No, no, not the one who was like running after him. So in any case, I decided to go down there. And, and another funny part is because I used to hear him talk on the phone with some other chaps, and they were telling him, let her do what she wants to do, and you have to try to save yourself, stuff like that. And I got very angry because I thought they're really disturbing my family, if you call that a family, you know what I mean? And I got a knife, and I went down to the meeting. That's what I did.
Wow.
I thought, I'm going to really deal with these people. And so I went to the meeting with a knife, and I sat in, and I never used again.
Wow. You went there to carry a message. But the message got carried to you.
Yes. It was just, I sat on the chair, listened, and I was completely taken by it. It was such an experience. It was like, oh my God, now I can breathe again in my life. It felt like I can breathe. Oh my God, it's safe. It's okay. I can breathe. I can do it. Oh, I'm saved. That's how it felt. I can remember. And I'll tell you, the sharings that day, I still remember them. They were horrible. There was a lady, she was really sick and she wanted to die. And then there was so much drama, like it was really bad. I got the message, tell me how. I don't believe anything in the program that happens is a logical experience. I think it's a spiritual experience. There is an intervention. Because the things we do in NA, they're completely crazy. And not very attractive either, you know. But it still works because something is there.
Something is there. You know, it makes me think, we hear ourselves say, I need to carry a positive message. And that's true. It's better if we can carry a positive message than just go dump on the meeting. But ultimately, what you're saying is such an example of our powerlessness and our best laid plans aren't really what make this thing work somehow.
Exactly.
How old were you then?
I was 34.
34, and how long have you been clean?
I'm clean 23 years.
23, all right.
Yeah, I just turned 23.
And how long has NA existed in Greece?
Well, 25, a little more than that, because when I got into the meetings, there was that was all there was, one meeting. Every day, not every day, 6 days a week in one place. That was the whole of NA. It was around 20 people that were there already. So it was another just a few years. It was those 20 people, you know, 15, 20 people. Yeah, and when I got in, I remember that it was like the week after that it was decided that we should have one every day. So there was one day that we didn't have a meeting and we made another meeting for the day. So it was one meeting every day. That was it. I mean, I remember that at the beginning, the first week when it was actually the new people that came in, it was my boyfriend then and a close friend, we're still in recovery, and myself. After a week of being clean, the three of us went out to celebrate. And celebrating, we thought we went out to drink. Because we didn't understand yet, you know, that you don't dream when you're in recovery, you know what I mean? So it was pretty, you know what I mean, just yeah. Basic stuff and very naive. And then when we went back to the meeting, we said, oh God, we got drunk. It was pretty horrible. And everybody said, guys, you're not supposed to be drinking, you know.
Wow.
So in any case, actually, I didn't even stay in that. I got very sick and very... I mean, that's why I'm saying it was a spiritual experience, because I got very repulsed that night of alcohol. I had a feeling of repulsion that I don't want to do this. I want to go home.
What literature was available? What was the status of available literature in Greece when you got clean?
The whole thing started from England. There were some people, Greeks in England, who found recovery. Okay. Now, those people, they came here to Greece and introduced NA, and somehow they got people together. I wasn't there yet, so I cannot really, I don't know much detail, but I know most of those people today because they're still clean and they're with us. And they brought in the literature. Now, immediately here, there was this lady, a member of the fellowship, she started translating, you know, with great passion. It was a lot of passion. So almost everything was available either in English or in Greek, you know, and because of the those Greek people, members that came from England, with all that, you know, they were translating as well. And so it was pretty okay for all of us to have literature very fast. Of course, it took many, many years and many translations and corrections and all that to get it, like to get the book published, you know, officially. It's only a few years that eventually, you know, but it has been a recovery process for different groups of us, taking the translation, correcting it. We'll get into groups, you know, like for years, you know, and then another group will take it and correct it. And somehow it was also a recovery process to do the translation.
Well, that's, you know, interesting. So your book, yeah, evolved. You didn't.
Yes.
Do you find that people, like here, I think it would be really difficult for us to evolve the book like that, because the difficulty in getting consensus on changing things, and then, okay, if we're changing that, well, we better get on about changing this or that. And it just seems like it would be a never ending. I mean, there's at least a fear of that, but you guys would discuss whether something was translated in the best way that it could be, and if it wasn't, you'd make another change.
Yeah, but you see, what made it easier comparing to what you've been describing is that it wasn't too many of us those days. So it's different when you have like 20 people busy with something, and instead of having like 200 people busy with something, you know, having an opinion, you know, amounts, you know, different numbers of people make it more difficult.
Yeah, that's true. Or tens of thousands of people who
exactly
feel really strongly about this passage or that passage, yes, and it really means, yes, something to them. All right. Well, when I first met you, you had been the delegate for Greece, mm-hmm, and then you got elected to the World Board. So at somewhere in there, you must have been involved during the development of the EDM. That when I say the EDM, for people who might be listening, I'm talking about the European Delegates Meeting, which is the zonal body that covers all of Europe, and then it has some other members that extend beyond Europe, like Israel, like Egypt, and maybe some others. I think for fellowships in Europe, the relationship to the EDM is so important, and then the relationship to the World Service Conference, that there's another relationship there to a service body that in the U.S. we don't quite have the same sense of. Well, can you describe at all the importance of the EDM in the development of the fellowship in Europe?
Yes, I can tell you the influence it had when the EDM happened here in Greece, you know.
You mean when the actual meeting was held?
When the actual meeting was held in Athens. I mean, the enthusiasm and the kind of expansion in our minds that we are not this little thing over here. We are part of a greater picture. I mean, that in itself, I think, has a power that is very hopeful, and it feels safe, it feels right. Now, this is an incredible feeling for small places. And you can see that it's happening today in Africa, in other places. You know, it happened a few years back, like when we started meeting with Russia. And it's an incredible feeling. Of course, in the meantime, technology came in, and people are not as astonished as we were back then, you know, because technology makes all these things very familiar to people already, mm-hmm, before you even meet with them.
Interesting.
But back then, it takes away a bit of the magic, but of course it gives a lot of other things.
Yeah.
But I remember those days, you know, it was in a lovely place in Athens, in the center of the hotel, and we were all busy with the people, you know, trying to be nice, you know, to take them out, to show them things, to be there. I was doing translations all the time, you know, like from morning until night, I was translating live, you know, like somebody would talk and would translate. And I'm telling you, you would never get tired. It was such a beautiful, beautiful experience. You know, Greece is a place that has a history of being isolated. We're not really the East, we're not really the West, we are just in this area. So the same thing, I think, took place concerning NA. You know, we were not really very close to another country, that we, but we were not far away either. So EDM did that, you know. For me, it's a glue. It's a glue, you know. EDM glued NA of Europe together.
There's really something there that is resonating for me in a big way, because when I got clean, first of all, there was only one meeting a week in the town where I got clean, and that meeting was growing and growing, but it was difficult to even start a second meeting because it almost felt like some kind of, I don't know, betrayal of the first meeting or something like that. And so then you start the second meeting, and as soon as you start the second meeting, then that opens the door and a bunch of meetings start. And then our fellowship had meetings every day, but we were still isolated as a community. And that first time we ever connected with the World Service Conference, I think, might have been similar to what you're talking about. And it's hard, I couldn't put it into words either. That feeling of now we are connected, now we are part of a bigger thing. And the first time we ever went to a world convention, a bunch of us, I mean, we had that experience like, holy cow, this thing is big, and its possibilities are big. And so that first time you connect with the EDM, it just changes your sense of who you are. You're not just isolated fellowship, but our fellowship is a member of something much bigger.
Yes, it's a kind of empowerment.
Yeah.
And you know, I guess this is the experience of most people. When you use, you're completely without power in society, in your family, everywhere. And I mean, everybody's entitled to this feeling of being empowered, you know, that I have it. So you get into NA, you stop drugs, and you also begin to have a kind of identity. And it's an identity that concerns a lot of people. You know, you belong into something bigger that has the power. But, you know, not on the bad side, on the good side, because we carry hope, we carry a message. It's kind of a miracle because it works on all levels. It works on a personal level, the way I started being not ashamed, you know, and respecting myself and finding a place where I was treated with respect and dignity came back into my life. But then there is the other level, which is the social arena, you know, and then it's the world arena. It's something, it has to do a lot, that empowerment, with self-respect. But only, not only on my personal life, in my little world, but also in the big world, you know, this is, for me, it takes away and it erases and it heals any kind of humiliation I have felt ever in my life. Because using and being a woman, back then, now too, I think, it's a very humiliating experience. You know, when somebody is 50 years old and is using, it's not seen so disrespectfully as a woman who's 50 and using, you know what I mean? And so what I'm trying to say, there was a lot of humiliation involved for me in my experience as a drug user. And my future really looked very gray, almost black. And being in NA on a personal level, it clears up all that. But then as a member of society, it makes a huge difference, because I went around to EDM. I went to places where DNA message was to be told. And I was treated with respect by the normal people. Yeah, you know what I mean?
I do know.
Not only with respect, but also admiration. You know, I mean, it's a huge, huge healing experience.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I see some people look at NA, at the 12-step programs, AA, NA, and et al., and say, well, they're based on this notion of admitting powerlessness. And I've heard it even expressed more pointedly around women, that the last thing a woman needs is to be told she's powerless. In general, the notion that how could you base this on telling people that they're powerless? I want people to hear that they're powerful or empowered. And I just think there's a paradox right at the center of NA, right at the center of the 12 steps that you just articulated, which is that this is about empowerment. It's, you know, at 20 years clean, you still say, I admit I'm powerless over my addiction. But that doesn't mean I am powerless, full stop. That doesn't mean I have no source of empowerment. And in fact, recovery is so much about empowerment. But
yeah, this is a very interesting point. It's but because I think recovery happens in different levels, you know. It's the things we the power that we take back concerning our lives through the responsibility we take of our lives. But then there is a spiritual connotation to being powerless. And maybe in the future, when we mature as a fellowship even more, we may write something about that, you know.
Can you expand on it a little bit?
Well, being powerless, it has to do with admitting your human limitation, right?
Yes.
But up to there, I think, this is just my personal thinking, there is the concept of responsibility, that I take responsibility for myself. I pay my bills, I watch out for my behavior, I take responsibility of my life, I don't depend on others. So it's responsibility. And then it's the acceptance of the limitation of human nature. I am powerless over that side of myself, and I better accept that instead of fighting. Because fighting something, it's not always the wisest way to get through it. Mm. Acceptance, we know from experience, is the way to win. So it looks like a paradox, but human nature is paradoxical in so many ways. So if we perceive it that way and make the distinction between the two, and maybe write and expand on it much more than what I'm saying, then it will make more sense to people. But yeah, definitely, when people tell me that I want to be empowered, I say, yes, of course you are empowered. You are powerless over that, over your addiction, you know, over that side of yourself that has the tendency to do stuff, you know, to take drugs, to behave in ways, to...
Yeah, it's... when I'm dealing with somebody who is, you know, afraid of this, like... am I now going to live in this sort of disempowered state? One way I've thought of it is thinking of what are the power centers within me? My ego, my will, my thinking. Okay, these power centers are insufficient equipment to fix addiction. And I gave it my level best from those power centers. So maybe another way of saying it is, those power centers are not the ones. They are insufficient. The power center, my spirit, my capacity for love, my capacity for wisdom, for vision, my spirit, my spiritual center, is what the steps awaken, and that is the power center that is sufficient to address addiction.
Yes. Oh, I love it. The way you described it, it's lovely. Okay. Write it down. It's really great. It's really great.
You and I had a conversation a little while ago because you had gotten sick. I left the board and you were still on the board. And then I talked to a couple of my friends and I said, how are things are going? How's Tonya? And they said, Tonya has cancer. And so let's just turn the conversation there a bit. I know that when you and I talked, I went, man, I wish I had the recorder on because we're talking about these. I mean, if you really want to explore the issues of the existential questions and the mortality questions, you should call a Greek, you know, and you should call a Greek who has come fully to life in recovery and then confronted mortality like that. So I don't know. I say that and just to set that up, and I don't know where we go with that conversation. Dave has been. Dave, how many heart surgeries have you had?
I've had two open heart surgeries, 6 months apart, 4 years
really?
Ago.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And then more recently, you had a smaller one, but also an important.
A cardiac ablation. So yeah, I've dealt with a diseased heart for a long time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, tell us about it, Tonya. What happened?
To begin with, so not to glamorize, because I know there are people who have been through much worse concerning cancer. Mine was a thyroid cancer, right? Which meant I had to have an operation to take away all the thyroid gland. But it looked, and I was told that it was a little difficult because it had spread it. You know, it had spread, you know, a little bit on the sides. So I did the operation, and I started recovering, and everything went well. And actually, now in a few days, I'm going to go for my 1 year test. It's a very specific test, which will show where I'm completely okay. And from now on, there's not going to be any kind of concern ever with it. You know, I'm just going to be taking a pill because I don't have a thyroid. I'm going to be taking a pill for the rest of my life, you know, for my hormones. It was a great opportunity for me to see myself. Because when something happens to you, you react, you feel, you think. And you start thinking about life, you know. So it's a great opportunity for me. It was great to, how can I say? I was going through it, and at the same time, I was observing myself. And I didn't expect me to be that mature. I was so surprised. So before I tell you this, I have to tell you something else. I've been suffering from panic attacks and great anxiety disorder all my life. And I was very fearful. I mean, fear was my main, how can I say, the main juice that ran in my body, you know. I don't think I had blood. I think I had fear. I was extremely fearful, which is for reasons that can easily be explained through my childhood and my experiences. And I was afraid of sicknesses and diseases and stuff like that. And I was too alert with my body. You know, I never trusted my body. I always believed that it will give up on me. You know what I mean? Of course, I've done lots of work through the steps and through other means I've used to help myself to go through the anxiety and all that. And everything helped, of course. But still, you know, it's my basic makeup to be fearful. So I was really surprised to observe myself by the way I went through it. I immediately realized why I got this cancer and not another cancer.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. It has to do, for me, It has to do with standing up for myself and speaking my truth. Mm. And also it has to do, I think, with my will, to use my will. I mean, I wasn't good at these things. I was the airy fairy type, you know. I wasn't solid on my feet. I didn't know myself. One thing is to talk, but another thing is to know what you want to talk about. You know what I mean? Myself was, how can I say, squashed through life. And I was the good girl, you know. I was nice. When you're too good, it's a pathology. It's a problem. Mm. So that means I never gave myself, I never had the opportunity to really explore myself and know who I am, what I want, what I desire, what kind of food I like, what kind of boyfriend I like, what kind of life I want to have, you know. For me, it was like just passing around, you know, kind of passive in a way. And of course I was fearful, and when you're fearful, you don't speak up. You allow people to do whatever they want on you, you know, that kind of thing. I couldn't stand up for myself. It took many years in recovery to be able to stand up for myself. And also took a long time to explore myself. Speaking up, that's how I connected, you know. I had this mother, you know, my mother was such a powerful woman, you know. I was scared of her all my life. And something very weird happened with my mother. I don't know if this altogether make any sense to you, but I'm just talking about it. My mother, out of the blue, although she was in very good health, 3 years ago, she got a stroke, right? She was a very powerful woman and very healthy woman. So she survived the stroke for 6 months, and she couldn't talk. Up to then, I couldn't talk to her. And then she was on a bed, she could understand some stuff, and she couldn't talk, and I could talk. So I took very good care of her, and I could communicate with her because she stopped talking. Wow. She won't shout, she won't blame me, she won't accuse me, she couldn't criticize me. And I was there, and I had the opportunity to show all the love I felt. She won't stop me, man.
Oh, that is great.
She won't stop me, and I could love her.
Did you feel that she was hearing you when she was really listening, maybe for the first time?
I hope so. I hope so. Mm-hmm. Because, as my mother, she was a hard woman. But as a woman, I would look at her life, and if she was in my hands, I would have supported her like crazy to grow up, to be able to be strong and take care of herself, you know, because she had her share of, you know, hardship. That's why she was hysterical and she was hard and that. But as a woman, if she was like a younger woman, like I do with the women in the fellowship, I empower them, you know. I really empower them. And as a woman, this is how I felt about my mom, you know. I wish I could. You were my child, you know. I would make you powerful. I would give it all to you, all the love and all the treats and all the tenderness, you know. Mm-hmm. My mother, I mean, I would try to hug her and she couldn't hug, you know what I mean? She was like solid. She was like, she was like staring at me if I would ever cry or express any kind of emotions. So those 6 months before she died gave me the opportunity to do that. It was such a great opportunity. Life is very weird.
Life is weird.
It gives you opportunities in such a peculiar ways, you know, really peculiar ways. There is no normal route to get in touch with your parents or to solve problems or to heal yourself. It's nothing. You're expecting something the usual way. Somehow we all have a structure in our head that how this will happen, but it doesn't, you know. I had plenty of those. Actually, for me, the biggest growing up for me internally It came with being sick. If you ask me now, if you tell me you have like the capacity to take away the previous year, would I give it to you? No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. And I'm really honest. I'm not acting brave or anything. No, I wouldn't, because I got most of my understanding about myself and people came through that year.
It's actually it strikes me that it's the same dynamic as we were just talking about with recovery. You confront that moment of powerlessness. And
exactly. You know, since you mentioned powerlessness again, once I found out what was going on with me, I don't know what happened. It was another spiritual experience, I think, because I gave in to it completely. I surrendered. I thought, okay, maybe I have to go. Maybe I have to go. And I started thinking, am I missing something? Is there something I haven't done? Do I feel that I haven't completed something? I have to clean up some stuff, you know? And the answer I got for myself is that the only thing I really want some time for is to enjoy the sea, to go into the sea a little more, because I love the sea. Because then I thought of all my relationships, all the things I have behind me. I felt completely, spiritually and existentially complete. I could go. How else would I know all that about me if it wasn't for that sickness? I could go. It was okay. So I made my will, it was nice.
I just really get it. In fact, I was talking with a sponsee the other day about the actual power of surrender, and it is an incredibly powerful thing, and all of the pain of it comes before the moment of surrender.
Yes.
It's the surrender point itself is actually the release from the pain, even of something really, really scary, like I might die now because I have cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The surrender point is the opening to freedom. So.
Yeah. So another characteristic while I was sick was that I was joyous. I was happy. I have laughed and enjoyed myself as I have never done in my life, you know. But you know, not in how can I say? I wasn't joyous about things or things that were happening. Something opened up inside me. It was my heart that was joyous, you know. Mm. My heart on its own, never mind what was happening around me, was joyous and ease. And I've remained this way, you know. There's something here in my heart that is always like, oh, I'm in awe, you know. Everything is beautiful and happy, happy. There is a Greek word that I cannot really translate that talks about being joyous and being happy. And it's a word that brings it.
What is the word?
Chara. And originally the word has to do with chari. And chari is, let me remember this in English, it's like a blessing. So joyous and happy, originally the word in Greek has to do with being blessed. And that's why I'm using that word. It's the Greek word that expresses much more of what I was feeling. It talks about, I felt blessed all along. Blessed.
So it's a word that bundles blessing, yes, happiness, yes, joy.
Yes.
Is it H-A-R-A-M or something like that?
H-A-R-A. No, it's H-A-R-A. I'll tell you another interesting experience. While I was having that treatment, it was the convention in Brazil. And I wasn't there, of course, but because of the connections we had, I could hear some of the shares in Brazil while I was you know, in that room, you know.
Wow. That's great.
It's very touching.
Well, let me ask you this, Tonya. You had talked about a history of panic attacks. Now, did the reality of this rather severe medical diagnosis and treatment, did that change your orientation with respect to that, or do you still have panic attacks?
No, I don't have. I had a terrible breakdown when I was 8 years clean, and I took medication for a while. And after that, I helped myself with natural products and stuff, but I'm not there anymore. I'm not there anymore. I had to confront my fears, my history.
So there'll be people hearing this who deal with this panic attack thing. And it is, I mean, I guess it goes without saying, very, very scary by its very nature. And it seems like it's hopeless, like it'll never go away. But so how would you say medication for a period of time? And what was the work that you did? Just, I guess, step work? Or how would you describe that?
A lot of I couldn't do anything. Panic attacks are extreme anxiety attacks, right? You can have anxiety that you can handle. And then you can have more anxiety that it's very hard to handle. But then you get into panic attacks where you lose who you are. You don't feel you're in your body. You know, it's a horrible experience. So when that happened, I lost it completely. The only way I have to describe it is that I was a mass of fear. You know, like you can get fearful, but then you have your logic, or you have something to battle with the fear. When I got into that, there was nothing to fight it with. It's like I was left with completely without any tools to help myself. So then it could only be medication. I couldn't even talk. It lasted 3 months. It was horrible. But then that was a kind of a breakdown. I like this expression you Americans have. I love it. I think it means, it reveals so much. It says, it broke me open. Because I was such a control freak over my emotions and trying to be good, and I was studying and I was getting an occupation, and you know, I was really so good, but then I wasn't paying attention inside. That was 8 years. There were deaths that happened in my life. I lost people I loved, and and I didn't deal with not to the extent that I needed with all those things. But I was functional, you know. But everything was buried in me. And it was buried alive. That's the way I felt them. They were buried alive, and they started screaming, you know. And then anxiety, panic attack, I broke open. This is what it did to me. I broke open. Since then, another level of recovery started occurring. It had to do with my spiritual values. It didn't have to do with the outside to prove that I'm good, I'm decent, all that. I started getting in touch with my soul. So that was another terrible experience that could I do without? No, it's a learning experience. Even that, you know, as long as you do it, you know what I mean? There is a drive, you know. Since I got into recovery, there is a drive. There is a longing. This is what opened up for me, the program. That longing for my soul, you know. I don't want to just exist, you know. I want to be. There was a longing. It's a feeling of love, and I don't know. It's such a warm feeling in my heart, you know. I want to find me. And I think this is find me. It's not really about me. It's about finding the connection between me and my higher power. And it's that kind of longing.
Yes.
And I think the program and the meetings, they are, how can I say, they resemble this higher power thing, you know what I mean? It's like the meetings are like a sample, you know, you get the taste, you get in there, and the people and the love and the problems and the rubbish, okay, but most of it, it's that. And that gives you a taste of something so much bigger, you know.
Yes.
I'm not making any sense.
Oh, yes, you are.
But it's...
Yeah, it's the microcosm and the macrocosm in a way. You get it.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're the same. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they are the same. They are the same. Yeah. I have a spiritual... a teacher that I love to listen to or read, and he says a number of things that are just like spot on here. One of them is he uses the phrase "the scandal of the particular," and I'm not.
I love it.
It's somehow it's that the experience that I have in the particular, in the immediacy of this moment contains the.
Yes.
The elements of the larger picture. I don't know how to say it either. I mean, we're...
It's the same in biology or quantum physics, you know? It's exactly the thing. There's the microcosm. You can spot onto the microcosm, which, if you really analyze it, it's very much like the big picture, you know?
Yes. And, you know, it actually provides... For people who say, I don't know about God, and I don't know what I believe, and I don't think I even do believe about a God, but I do believe in the love of this fellowship, and I do believe in the support that I get from this fellowship. It's really that you could say that there is this, you could be saying, I don't know how to put my head around the macrocosmic view of this kind of loving embrace, this entrance into freedom that comes from surrender, et cetera, et cetera. But I do know what the microcosm of it feels like. And that is when I surrender to my addiction and I seek help and I get it in a very loving way in NA. So, I mean, it's one way of understanding that. One way is to say maybe the group is the conduit for a higher power. Another way is to say maybe the group is a microcosm of the higher power, which is the macrocosm of that same sort of loving, nurturing thing.
It's better to say it's a conduit because we do a lot of not good stuff, you know. So it's good that the macrocosm is not doesn't have that part of the microcosm.
I really understand what you're saying. It's an imperfect imperfect conduit is probably a better...
No. The thing that really amazes me a lot is we are all so incomplete, you know, and we can be so unkind and we can be so wrong in so many ways to each other very often. And we can get paranoid and all kinds of things, you know. And I'm talking about a group or the conference or whatever, you know. And still, it goes on, you know. The goodness survives it all.
Mm.
So because of that, I've decided to take all the other stuff as little spots. You know, all the bad stuff we do, it's like, it's events. It's events that make us grow and teaching processes. But the base of it all is goodness. The basis is goodness. And sometimes we turn weird, you know, we harm each other or we say things and stuff like that. But I think goodness takes it all.
Hmm.
You know, like in the movie Mamma Mia, have you seen the movie with Meryl Streep? You know, that's a song from ABBA, "The Winner Takes It All." So I'll paraphrase it. I love that song. And it's the goodness takes it all in and transforms it into goodness again through the learning.
And in fact, there might not be a better example of that principle than NA in a way. Because we're all so imperfect. We come here because we're completely broken down addicts. And there's nobody here but us. And somehow the goodness takes it all in the end. Somehow, at least in some overarching sense, there's a goodness that is growing and growing and growing in this thing, this fellowship.
And it's growing no matter what.
No matter what.
No matter how much we try to go against it, it doesn't get affected. We think we can affect it, no? And I don't, so that's why I never believe that NA is in any kind of danger ever, because all the things we perceive as dangerous sometimes every now and then in the fellowship, you know, in a little meeting or in the bigger picture, it is just growing processes of the people, of the members. It cannot affect.
A friend of mine used to say, that's because God loves fools and dope fiends. So, Dave, we've kind of talked into some of this stuff around mortality, around the surrender of illness and recovery. And I know this is something you actually have a lot of really personal experience with yourself. I'm just wondering if you want to say anything about that, add anything to that, or ask Tony anything about that, or any of the above?
Sure. Well, I'd known from a very early age that there was an irregularity in my heart, and it turned into an arrhythmia, actually at a meeting about 17 or 18 years ago, and it's anyone who's had profound and prolonged cardiac arrhythmia knows it can be very disquieting and enervating. So we were just keeping an eye on it, and I remember the day I received the phone call from my cardiologist, and he said, it's time for you to call the surgeon. So I knew that my life was going to change, and that happened just a little over 4 years ago. And it's a very interesting time in my life because, and I talk about it a lot at meetings for a number of reasons. One, of course, confronting mortality. To, you know, trying to prepare yourself. I mean, when you talk about being powerless, you know when you're on that table and they're wheeling you down that hallway into the operating room, you are completely powerless. You know, something is going to go in your arm any second and it's lights out. And what it did for me was it gave me a very primal need to connect with my higher power. And I just prayed my way through that. And I know that in both the surgeries, they were 6 months apart. The first one, the valve they gave me failed. But in both of those surgeries, I was praying as I was going under. And for me, that was a very positive thing because it gave me even more encouragement to connect with my God in a very immediate and personal way. And then the other thing that was surgery and is dealing with the aftermath and dealing with having to be medicated, which is, you know, a real problem for addicts. So it's become something I talk about quite a bit, you know, when I share at meetings. And it's something that I may have to face again because the valves that they give you only last so many years. So if I'm lucky enough to be around a long time, I'll have to go through that surgery again. But it was one of there have been a number of instances in my recovery of these events that have really forced me to reconnect with my recovery and to try to really figure out what's most important in my life and to connect with people and to be able to ask for help and to accept help. And like Tony, I had a period earlier in my life where I like that expression too. It broke me open. I had a psychological experience very similar to Tony's. And I think, Tony, you talked about this sense of being outside of yourself. And yours was born of fear. Mine came as a result of stress. And I had a very profound break of that kind where they call it the psychologist depersonalization, which is a form of dissociative reaction. And it sounds like that's what you were talking about. And for me, it took me about 18 months or 2 years to really get back to the point through professional counseling and a lot mm-hmm. of meetings and a lot of talking about it to get back to a point where I felt completely at home in myself again. And I had to talk about it. The night it happened, I shared it at a meeting, and it was one of the most difficult things. I had this horrific shame about something that had happened to me kind of psychiatrically, as if I was somehow to blame for that. So that, and that was 20 years ago. So that also propelled me to really try to reengage my own recovery. So, I mean, all of this, and to hear you share about these kinds of things, what's really important for that to me and to hear it expressed by so many people is very few of us have straight line recovery, what I call straight line recovery. It's a myth that we're going to run into these points in our recovered lives where we have the medical crises, the psychiatric mm-hmm. crises. And yes. what's so reassuring is to hear how you've stayed committed to your recovery and use the fellowship to reground you and to heal through these events, these challenges.
Yeah, I mentioned this spiritual teacher who says things that resonate for me. And one another thing he says is, those of us who are ready to die are those of us who are most practiced at dying. Those of us who will be most ready at the time of our death are those who are most practiced at dying. And it's kind of this principle we keep saying over and over. I keep seeing it in this conversation over and over, that there is the build up to surrender, which is where all the pain and stress and fear and anxiety and all of that is in the build up to surrender. There is the surrender itself, which is that moment where you just let it go, and you have this different it translates into such a different way of seeing, and then this period of freedom and whatever that Greek word was you were using, Tonya, that opens up at that point, that mix of kind of paradoxical joy and happiness mm-hmm. and being blessed.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm thinking a lot about and feeling my way through all that. And I think dying is overestimated, because dying is a constant process while we are alive. I mean, do you want to grow? Do you want to move ahead? You need to die. Parts of us die all the time. My idea of being 20 has to die. Mm. My idea of being helpless and has to die, has died. My idea of being alone and nobody loves me has to die, has died. You know, I mean, we die in so many ways, and if we realize that we die, it's hard as a process, but we die with pleasure in our lives. While we're alive, lots of our parts of ours die in order to grow. How will you move into the next if you don't let go of the previous one? So sometimes I'm thinking, okay, logically, if this is what we do while we are alive, who knows? I mean, maybe this is what happens when we actually physically die. We move into another level. Into another level, I don't know, space, level, whatever. We have to leave the physical body behind and move into another area of whatever learning there has to occur.
Yes.
And in the meantime of all of it, you just have to serve your fellow human being. And that's it, you know? That's my understanding of life.
There it is. And it's when he talks about that, he often references the 12 steps. He says the people who know this are those people. Some of them might be the ones in church on Sunday morning, but they're the ones that are meeting in the basement of the church on Wednesday night. Those are the guys who know this.
Ah, that's a nice way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Let me say something about the the way I feel and I've discovered about the steps.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to find my way through the steps and understanding them and appreciating them. And I used to feel kind of trouble because I didn't understand them right from the beginning somehow. In any case, what I want to say is that in the course of my life, I've studied a lot of different things. And I read a lot, you know, and I'm interested in religion, philosophy, that kind of thing. Whatever is connected to the meaning of life, to human beings and all that. So while I was studying all those different things, officially or unofficially, you know, either at school or by myself, I'm going to describe something that has happened to me so many times. Every time I was going through a book and that, I thought, damn it, this is in the steps. And then I would read Buddhism and practice Buddhism, and I thought, oh God, this is in that step. And then I would go into Christianity, and then I would find that, and then I would go into other hidden Christian, you know, philosophies and things that, and then I would find that in the step. And so I've come to the conclusion, I mean, the steps are available and we can do them the way they do them, but they have in them such incredible wisdom. I mean, on itself, I personally have tried a lot of ways, you know, I've never left an A, I'm always in an A, but I've always, you know, experienced other ways to do it. And today I believe that if we can really understand the steps, you really don't need anything else in life to understand what's going on. It's all there. It's amazing because every time I have this experience, that it's here. Whatever I read, you know, the most peculiar thing, even from physics, you know, I can find it in the steps. I mean, what kind of intervention was that to be able to put together something such a simplistic level that even if you, you know, can barely read, it makes sense to you. And even if you have 50 years of recovery, it still means so much to you. It's an incredible tool. The more you grow and mature, the more you see them. You see more in them because you grow. It's always there. But it has to do with my growing up, you know, with my maturing, that I will see more of it, which was there in any case, in any way, it was there. But I couldn't see it, you know. Right. My first years of recovery, I could see so much and understand of the steps, you know. Today I can see a completely different thing on the steps.
Yeah.
But it was there, nothing changed. I still read the same thing, you know. It's the same book.
What changed is the lens that you read the book through, right?
Yes, but that has all those meanings all along. It had them.
Yeah, I hear you. If you think about what the steps promise, I mean, what they don't promise it in the words of saying, here's what we promise. But what the promise that's held out is an awakened spirit.
Yes.
Awakened spirit. And the word awaken to me means move from one level of consciousness to another.
Another.
So, that's right. And this is not a switch, an A-B switch. In switch A, I'm asleep. In switch B, I'm awake. These are gradations of awakening.
Yes.
So
yes.
That to me is what, I had a conversation this morning with a sponsee. We were talking about his four step. He's done a four step before. But I said, he's going to use the same guide. So I said, well, you've never done a fourth step from here before. You know, you've never done a fourth step from this vantage point of awakening before. And you see things differently. So that to me is, that's what I hear you saying, that
yes,
as I awaken, I begin to see the same things that were there all along, but I see them now, or I see them differently. I see
more to them.
Which is why I think what I heard you saying, the steps never get old in that sense. They never become obsolete. They never become the thing that newcomers do to stop using. You know, they become the thing that people with a lot of time do to take it to the next level.
Yes, and it's like a tool, you know, it's like those You know those games where they Transformers and stuff like that? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those toys, the Transformers, you know, somebody that, you know, transforms. The steps have that capacity. As I grow, they transform. It's exactly the same thing, but it transforms. I transform, it transforms. And somehow you go together, you know, you transform together. Yes, as you said, it never gets old, and it can be with you all along. All along.
Yeah. You know, it made me think of the word transform, transformational, versus sort of incremental growth, but transformational experience, where you can't get by without the incremental growth. I mean, we do grow incrementally, but there are things that are transformational in nature, and they are when spirit awakens and I perceive from a different vantage point, and that can be transformational as opposed to incremental.
Yes. It's like nothing changes, but everything changes.
Yes.
Because you are changed, because I'm changed. I'm changed. And this is such a blessing, to be able to be given the space, the opportunity to change. I so appreciate that, you know. I so appreciate the way I've changed, because I can live with myself. I can be with myself. And it can be a joyful experience instead of a dramatic one or a painful one. It can be a joyful experience because I've changed. And this is what I always wanted. I wanted to change, to go to a place where I'll be me, and not all my experiences or the circumstances, me.
Which is confounding at a certain level of awakening to say, Ron, just be yourself. You want to answer, which self would you like? You know, at another level of awakening, that you, what a joy it is to just actually get to emerge as me.
Yes. You know, I recovery for me, I always had this image, what it looks like. And I always looked that I am far out, further out. And I come slowly. I come into me.
That's great.
From the outside to the inside. And I think the wisdom of the steps is exactly that. They put you into yourself. They help you find out who you are, who you really are. Clean up experiences, clean up influences, traumas. Clean them up, because they don't allow you to see who you are. When they are alive and kicking, all those things, because our self is buried under. That's where we have to do the fourth and the fifth and the sixth and the seventh, and of course the eighth and the ninth, and then we can really be in touch with us, the real us.
Yeah. All right, well, we are in that twilight of this interview, and so I guess I want to ask you first, Tanya, do you have anything else like that? Something that sort of stirs in you that you'd like to just express? Anything else going on in there?
Yes, I'll tell you something that's going on. It's a thought about pain. I do realize, and we say things like no pain, no gain. We learn through pain. Me too. I've learned through pain. I mean, all my experiences had to do with pain. But I'm suspecting that there is another way of doing all that. And it's the joyous way. I think pain, yes, I know, but it's overestimated. You can really learn through joy. So far, this is what we do, I understand, but I've discovered that lately, that I can learn through joy. It doesn't need to be through pain, which means that if I surrender, like you've been saying, it can happen in a joyful way. Pain is caused because we deny, because we resist. If you don't do that, there is joy. You know, if you like open your arms, like you want to take a child into your arms with all your love, and you take it all in faith, you know, in trust that it's not gonna hurt me. It's a loving thing, you know. I can take it all in. It's gonna make me grow. It can be a joyous experience.
I think it really needs to be said because, yes, pain is, you know, the quote unquote touchstone of spiritual growth. Pain is where so much benefit comes when looking back. So people then will sometimes glorify the pain as though the pain is the good thing that I should be seeking. And what I hear you saying is that the pain goes to the surrender point, the post-surrender, where so much can happen is joy.
Joy.
There's a whole family of verbs that you could say are in the family of exertion. I exert myself in, you know, A, B, C, D, you know, different mm-hmm. verbs. There's another family of verbs that are in the allowing. I allow. And the ones that really lead to the best stuff in recovery are the, well, there's both, but as far as that kind of spiritual awakening, that post-surrender benefit that I'm going to get in recovery, it's going to be allow the joy, experience my joy, experience my, that sense that I am not the one in control, whatever that is, you know. It's such a thing. We fear the loss of control. And when you actually let it go and you go, okay, there's a joy in it. There's a mysterious joy in it.
You know, this verb, what you said, to allow it, I think it's the key. I think what I was doing while I was sick or during other tough times of my life is, I think this is what was happening. I was allowing it and living it. You know, participating in it, mm-hmm. not out of my body, in my body, stay mm-hmm. there and observe myself being sick, observe myself possibly dying, observe myself feeling abandoned by my boyfriend, observing myself being financially broke, you know, all those things that happen in life. Stay with it. Don't run. It's okay. You know, like, it's magnificent once you stay with it.
And there's something really fundamental to recovery in that. I don't know if you heard the interview that we did with these guys that were in the prison and they got to come out to our convention?
Yes.
Do you remember the one guy, his name was Daniel, he said that his son, or I can't remember if it was his son or daughter, was graduating while he was in prison and he couldn't be there for the graduation. He said, and that broke my heart.
Yes.
And then he said, and here's what recovery gave me, the ability to allow it to break my heart.
Yes, I love that part. I love that, the ability.
Exactly. Because before I had to, in a panicking kind of way, fix it. I can't allow my heart to be broken. I've got to fix it. And there you get into using and manipulating and whatever else, but allowing myself to be, just as you just said, in the broken heart or whatever it is. It's so counterintuitive to the brain until you've got some practice with it, some experience of it. Mm-hmm. All right, well, time to say goodbye.
Okay.
I love you, Tonya.
I love you, Ron, too.
Goodbye, Tonya. So nice to meet you.
So nice. Dave, thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much. It was an honor.